Well, last week we didn't quite finish the final lecture on the ideology and consciousness section. There remain some issues around the micro foundations and psychological mechanisms underlying ideology that from Elster's presentation. I think that, and I said at the end that I would just spend the first part of this lecture wrapping that up. But in going over my notes for what's ahead in this week till the end of the semester, I actually think I don't want to shortchange our engagement with the theory of history, which has lots of things to talk and discuss. So I'll just make one final wrap-up point about the ideology discussion, what the whole reason for that going into Elster's mechanisms for talking about these hot and cold cognitive and emotional dimensions of ideology, which culminated in that little 2x2 table at the end of the notes. The reason for all of that is to say that if you believe that ideology is important, that is one of the reasons why we have stability in capitalist societies, and one of the obstacles to their transformation has to do with the way people think about capitalism. So that's essentially, if you don't believe that, then there's no point in bothering with studying ideology. The reason to bother studying about it is because you believe it's one of the things which figures in this problem of the social reproduction of an unjust society, the way people think and understand that the society. Well, if you believe that, then understanding what is it in our interior mental lives that makes those ideas have force, that anchors them, what are these underlying psychological mechanisms, has to be part of the analysis, ultimately. And particularly, if you have anything but the most simple-minded view about how you transform these ideological conditions, you have to understand what anchors them in people's subjectivity. Anything other than a simple inertial view, you hold these ideas because you've been taught them and they sit there until they get changed by being taught something else. Well, nobody really believes that kind of really simple learning view. It has to have more force. And Elster is mapping out at least some of the dimensions of the underlying psychological processes which provide these mechanisms which make ideas sticky, which make them once held, be held in place, but also vulnerable to transformation. It means that revolutionaries and radicals and activists have a therapeutic role to play in the world, not just a political role. That is, they have to understand how minds work and how to engage people to transform those ideas. And that's where I think the left has this deep kind of moral dilemma, because if you're committed to the view that what we want is a world of democratic participation and self-determination, free of manipulation, in a sense, if you learn all these psychological processes and you learn how you could cleverly manipulate people to change their ideas, you have to abstain from using that knowledge if you're going to be true to the goals that you aspire to. But that's a disabling commitment in the context of battles where the opposing ideological forces are perfectly comfortable manipulating, lying, distorting, playing off of fears irrationally in order to get people to support positions. And there is this tension. Not everybody feels it, you know. Some people are perfectly happy engaging in the same kind of strategies as the right does. But I think there is pretty broadly a tension between what one might call the Enlightenment commitment towards reason, which is at the heart of the view that a deliberative democratic society is both achievable and desirable. There's a tension between those values and these psychological processes which anchor beliefs that are obstructions to social change. And it's an unresolvable tension. It's what makes me uncomfortable about some of the discussions around framing and Lakoff as this linguistic psychologist at Berkeley who's written a lot about the success of the right wing and being able to frame questions in ways which anchor people on the right, with the implication that we should do the same manipulative strategies. And I find that disturbing. But I can't say he's wrong. You know, it's not, I can't make the scientific claim. No, you don't have to worry about this. You do have to worry about it. But can reason and straightforward, clear argument defeat manipulation and fear? Can it? Is this a fair fight, as it were? There's this kind of naive belief, which I hold on to, that, you know, I suppose it has a certain pedigree within the Christian tradition as well, the truth will set you free, right? It's just all you need is the better argument. But we know that that's not, in fact, how ideologies work and how the psychological infrastructure of ideologies work. And therefore, what do you do? Do you accept the terms of the struggle that are imposed upon you by the powers you're trying to overcome, but in so doing corrupt, in a sense, the goals themselves? It's another kind of dilemma. You know, so we, in the Shavorsky story, we face the dilemma of participating or not in a political game, which if you participate in tends to eviscerate your radicalism, but if you don't, you're marginalized. So which is worse, marginalization or co-optation? Similar kind of issues, perhaps, in ideology, in the struggle over ideologies, co-optation or marginalization. Well, I'm just expressing the dilemma. I really don't have an answer to that question. But with that said, let's move on to another one of these fantastically cool topics, the theory of history. I mean, this is really, you should just, in a way, what you need to do now is just put on your appreciative intellectual hat, where you just want to look at the structure of an argument and try to really understand the brilliance of the way this problem was tackled. And then we'll invoke the problems with it. But I think it's important with historical materialism not to be too impatient to criticize it. I mean, I'm very critical of some of the key arguments in historical materialism. I think the theory of history has the kind of flaws that are probably not remediable. They probably can't be fixed. And therefore, it's an important historical body of ideas, and there are insights from this body of ideas which are robust. It's just that they don't all fit together as neatly as the theory purports. Still, I think it's worth really appreciating and understanding both the ambitiousness of this theory and how it works. And to get at that, we need to begin by just approaching a kind of meta question. What, in fact, does it even mean to have a theory of history? What does it mean for history as such to be the object of a theory? And so that is not a question that people maybe are accustomed to ask. I think most historians don't actually ask that question. You know, they don't ask them, what does it mean to be studying history as such? So there is a negative answer to this, and the negative answer may ultimately be the proper answer, that history is not a legitimate object of scientific theory. There's things that are close, that in which the word history appears, that are legitimate objects, but history as such, whenever I say history here, by the way, I mean the history of human civilization and development. It's not... So perhaps we can have, here are three examples of theories that could be historical without being a theory of history. They're historical theories, but not theories of history. So what could we explain? Well, for example, specific events in history. We can certainly have explanations of particular events. We can explain the First World War. We can explain the French Revolution. Can explain the fall of the Soviet Union. Each of these historical events and processes that occurred in a limited period of time have causes. They have antecedent conditions which made them likely or unlikely. And you can talk about the relationship between the systematic conditions that were present and the triggering causes that, given those contexts, generated the actual events. So we certainly can have specific theories of specific events, and you can string those explanations together. I mean, after all, in a sense, if you explain the French Revolution, explain the aftermath of the French Revolution, explain the Restoration, explain the deterioration of the Restoration, explain the 1830s tumult, explain the, you know, if you explain one event after another and string them together, you can say, yes, I've explained the whole trajectory from 1789 to 1989. You know, I've explained that. Well, you really haven't. What you've done is you've explained a series of conjunctures of specific events and just stuck them together. But that's not, in any meaningful sense, an explanation of the entire trajectory. It's an explanation of each of the pieces of the trajectory. But that's one kind of theory of history. That's possible. So that's one meaning of what it means to take history as your object, is to take the events of history as your object of explanation and to string them together. Another thing is you could explain specific historical patterns or changes. So, for example, the Industrial Revolution. So the Industrial Revolution isn't an event. It's not like the French Revolution. It doesn't have a date, July 14th, 1789, that you say, aha, that's when it began. No, the Industrial Revolution is a label given to a long historical process that gets concentrated in particular intensity in a, I don't know, 4 to 8 decade period, depending upon exactly how you want to focus, beginning in the late 18th century and really coming into its own in the middle to end of the 19th century. So there's a kind of 100-year period, roughly speaking, let's say, which is the site of the Industrial Revolution. And that's explainable. That can be treated as an object of explanation for sure. So we can have specific historical changes or specific patterns in particular times and places that are explainable. And we can call that a legitimate object of theory. And finally, another meaning of saying that history as such is part of our explanations, part of our theory, is we can have theories of the concrete historical contexts of what we are studying. A lot of what sociologists mean when they talk about historical sociology is historically contextualized sociology. Our theory of economic inequality, for example, can say we don't have a theory of economic inequality that applies to everything from ancient Greece to post-industrial America. Rather, we have a theory of economic inequality and how it's generated and reproduced in 21st century United States and a whole set of other processes and causal mechanisms involved in ancient Athens. And ancient Athens and the United States are different historical periods, and that's why there are different causal processes in place. So we need an historically contextualized theory of whatever it is we're studying. You can't have an ahistorical theory of inequality. You need an historically concrete theory of inequality. And then you have to decide what the historical scope and space of that context is. So when we say we need a theory of inequality for the United States in the 21st century, one possible meaning for that is, what we really need is a theory of inequality in capitalist societies. That's the historical context. Or we might mean something way more specific than that. That depends upon the nature of your argument. Historical specificity of an argument, however, is not the same as a theory of history as such. It's really saying that we need is a contextual theory of all the specific causal processes and structures in place. Oh, and by the way, some of those occurred in the past and some of them are in the present. But it's really a structural description of the context, which is what it means to give it historical specificity. Those are all examples of using history, of having historical theories, but not having history as such as the object of theory. In this negative answer, it says it's basically a waste of time to try to develop a theory of history. It's a fool's errand. You can't accomplish it. So it shouldn't be an, you know, you can play with it, but you can't succeed in it. The positive answer is, no, it may be difficult. We may not be able to do a fine-grained theory of history, but there is something we can theorize about the overarching trajectory of human history from its misty beginnings in literate pre-recorded time, but sometimes called prehistory, but it just means that the documentation is different, the data would be different. We can have a theory that explains the overall trajectory from that period to the present. This is theorizable. It's a legitimate object. Well, to explain what even that means, what are we talking about if we aspire to that? I think it will be helpful to draw some contrasts. You know, this is sort of my typical strategy. The way to give specificity to any particular idea is to create a contrast space. So let me give you as examples three theories of history that are very successful. None of them are complete, but they're all very successful, but they're not about human history. Cosmology, evolutionary biology, and organismic development. So first, cosmology. Cosmology tries to develop a scientific theory of the origins of the universe and its trajectory of development over the last, 7 billion years? How old is the universe supposedly since the Big Bang? The Earth is 4.5 billion, 7 or 8 billion. All right, so we have to explain something that started 7 or 8 billion years ago, explain how we got from there to here and where we're going. Cosmology actually attempts to give an account of the ultimate fate of the universe. Not just a retrospective account of how we got from the Big Bang to the present, but how we get from the present to some distant future. And a big debate, I mean, this is a kind of popular science characterization. One of the big questions is, does the universe end in fire or ice? This is one of the kind of views, and the basic issue of the fire or ice view about the destiny of the universe is whether the gravitational forces in the universe are sufficiently strong that eventually the universe stops expanding and then begins contracting. That's the fiery end to the universe, because if the gravitational force in the universe is sufficiently strong that it eventually slows down in its expansion. The expansion was set in motion by the Big Bang, which sort of spewed everything out into an expanding universe. It didn't spew everything out into the universe. It started the expansion of the universe. Eventually it starts contracting, and in that vision, it's a kind of yo-yo, right? That it contracts, and eventually the kind of image is you have a second Big Bang, right? Another universe gets formed as everything collapses into a single point. The ice view is that, no, the forces of gravity are not strong enough. Eventually it just keeps expanding, and eventually it just dissipates into nothing because all energy will have dissipated from the universe and we end in a permanent void of emptiness. Well, fortunately, that's tens of billions of years away into the future, whatever that means. That is an example, though. I mean, that is a real theory of history. It's a history of the universe. It has this starting point, the Big Bang, so-called, which has all sorts of mysterious properties to it. There's no good explanation of how to explain the Big Bang itself. There's various ruminations on that question, and some people some physicists say it's a non-question because there is no meaning to the term what happened before the Big Bang. The word before has no meaning. That is, I think, functionally equivalent to the, in religion, if you ask, well, who created God? People say, that's a stupid question. There is no it's not that there's no answer to the question, it's a non-question, right? So the answer to the question, who created God, is, what are you talking about? God isn't the sort of thing that gets created, it just is. That's the standard religious answer to that question. Well, the physicist's answer to the question, what happened before the Big Bang, is, what are you talking about? There is no before the Big Bang. It's when four started, so to speak. Well, okay, there's problems with the theory. There's places where people are a little uncomfortable. I think most physicists who say that in their heart of hearts know there's something a little finessing about the question. It doesn't seem quite right to our human intelligence. But it's a really good theory of history. Second really good theory of history that's just an unbelievably powerful theory, given its simplicity, which is evolutionary biology through natural selection. I mean, it's just extraordinary that you can explain why whales are descended from creatures that look like mice. So the theory of mammalian evolution is that in the Jurassic period, when mammals first appeared and were a small niche species and didn't have much of a role in the overall environment, they were little tiny mammals, mouse-ish. I don't think they were rodents, but they were little scurrying creatures. Once the dinosaurs were wiped out and there were 90% of species disappeared in one of the great extinctions, so there was a huge space in the environment for speciation. Mice developed into whales. Oh my God, that's a ridiculous idea. Well, it's a pretty sound theory, and we can actually explain it. Evolutionary biology is an amazing theory. Now, it has two gaps, I think. Evolutionary biology itself can't explain the origins of life. That has to be explained by something other than evolutionary biology. And there's various views about the primordial soup, so-called, and what it took for self-replicating molecules to emerge, and then for self-replicating molecules to aggregate into bounded organisms, and how that happened. But that's pretty speculative still. There's gestures at theoretical understanding of that part of it. And the other gap in the argument, there's plenty of gaps within the details of evolutionary biology, which is why evolutionary biology continues to be a lively field of discovery. I'm talking about the overall architecture of the theory. The other kind of gap is really no idea of where things are heading. That is, it's not a predictive theory about the future. It has no ability to say a million years from now, 100 million years from now, what are the likely creatures? What will their shapes be? What's the future of evolution? It's entirely a retrospective theory. An incredibly powerful one, but has no predictive ability. Biologists have sometimes tried to make arguments that once you get single-celled organisms, so once you get that far, which took some billion plus years from the first self-replicating molecules to the first cell and then to the first multicellular organism. That was billions of years of evolution. So some people would like to say, once you get that far, eventually you're going to get neurologically complex creatures. Most biologists say no. There's no reason for increasing complexity culminating in nervous systems capable of theorizing evolution. There's no process which generates that trajectory. It's just the trajectory we happen to have had. I will invoke this book later in a more specific way, but there's a fantastic book for any of you who are interested in these things called A Wonderful Life by Stephen Jay Gould. Stephen Jay Gould was an evolutionary biologist who also wrote wonderful columns in the New York Review of Books and other places on evolutionary biology, and has published a dozen or so very prominent popularizations of evolutionary biology. He was also a scientist and made major contributions in the science of evolution, and has a book that is, I think, considered one of his best, called A Wonderful Life, which was based on his studies of the evolutionary record of fossils in Western Canada. In, I forget the name of the, it has a famous name, the deposit, the Burris Shale, I think is what it's called. Doesn't matter what the deposit is. Which is a record of one of the mass extinctions. So there are these various periods where nearly all life on Earth gets wiped out for one reason or another, and species decline. Well, the metaphor in the book, A Wonderful Life, comes from the movie with Jimmy Stewart, It's a Wonderful Life, where how many of you have seen the movie? Okay, it's a Christmas movie. It's worth seeing. It's a great, great classic American movie. The basic story is there's this small town banker who is a really wonderful person and uses the bank to help people. And that was true for small town bankers. They would see a business in distress and they would make bridging loans available just to help people get through rough patches. Whereas big corporate banks never would do that sort of thing. And it's one of the issues in American society is this disappearance of these kinds of community-oriented banks. So he was a really successful banker like this. And then there's a financial crisis and his bank is failing and his whole life is falling apart and he's considering committing suicide. He's on a bridge about to jump off and a guardian angel comes down and talks to him. And this guardian angel has to save one more soul before he can end his job. So he's trying to convince Jimmy Stewart not to commit suicide. And he takes him back into town and shows him what life in that town would have been like if he had never existed. So it's essentially saying, let's go back 30 years and let's just pretend you hadn't been here in this town. This is what things would be like. And there's all these successful people in the town whose lives are miserable because of the crucial role he played in helping them get over difficulties. And he then comes to realize that actually his life has mattered and he's made this difference that he hadn't understood. And then the townspeople come to his rescue, right? So it all ends happily. Well, that metaphor of running the tape of history over so you can see what it would be like if something hadn't happened. That's Stephen Jay Gould's metaphor for evolutionary biology. And what he says is, if you start with the earliest single-celled organisms, 3 billion years ago, or however, 2 billion years ago, whatever, and you had 1,000 planets, or you ran the tape 1,000 times, you ran the history over 1,000 times, you'd end up with 1,000 different outcomes. There'd be no reason whatsoever to expect the same. And there were body plans for species 2 billion years ago that are completely wild, they're like out of science fiction, and they don't exist on Earth today. And they don't exist on Earth today not because they weren't well suited to our planet, but because an asteroid hit the planet at a certain point in time and wiped everything out. And under the altered conditions of the transition back to a new equilibrium, it wasn't hospitable to that particular body plan. But that's contingent. Okay, well, that's evolutionary biology. Fantastic theory, but only of the past to the present, with a simple, powerful mechanism. Random variation plus natural selection. That gives you the whole diversity, plus contingency. Okay, third example of a really successful theory of history is the theory of the development of an individual organism from fertilized, in the mammalian case, from fertilized egg to embryo to fetus to infant, to adolescent, to mature adult, to decrepit, declining adult, to death. There's well-defined stages along that process, well-defined crises of transformation from one stage to another, well-defined and well-understood processes of aging and development. And it's an extraordinary theory, which still has gaps. So the theory of cell differentiation of a fertilized egg from a fertilized egg into a embryo with the development of specific organs. Well, there's been a lot of progress recently understanding epigenetic aspects of this and how juxtaposition of one kind of cell next to another contributes to their differentiation. I mean, all of this differentiation of cells from a single cell is pretty amazing to end up with all of our different body parts in the right places. But it's not fully understood, but it's pretty well understood. And the sequencing is understood. So you know that once you have a fertilized human egg, you're not going to end up with a baby duck. Never happens. Right? Now, there may be miscarriages, so it's not the case that you can predict from the fertilized egg everything. You can't do a fine-grained account of everything about that particular instance, but you do know what the overall possible trajectories are. And you know, do even have a theory of why you might not make it to a certain stage. And some of the theories about why you might not make it to the certain stage are endogenous to the process, and some are exogenous. So you can't predict from a fertilized egg whether an 8-year-old child is going to get hit by a bus or not, which will mean that particular fertilized egg never becomes an adult. Of course not. That's the equivalent of an asteroid hitting the Earth. It's an entirely contingent exogenous factor that has nothing to do with the theory of the development of the organism. It's entirely dependent. Our theories could not possibly simultaneously explain the development of a fertilized egg into an adult person and have the same theory explain the probability of getting hit by a bus. You require a different theory. You need a theory of traffic engineering and the exposure of children to different kinds of risks, which is a different kind of theory than the theory of development of organisms. But the theory of organisms, really, it gives you amazing things that you want from a theory. It tells you what the next stage is going to be. And it tells you about some of the difficulties of moving from one stage to another. And some of those stages are easy to move to and some are not. They have different perils, et cetera, et cetera. And it even gives us a reasonable theory of lots of deviations from the standard path. So you understand why certain kinds of nutritional environments of the gestating baby will produce low birth weight and subsequent cognitive deficits, perhaps. That's a current sort of development. Well, that's a pretty fine-grained account of the overall trajectory that enables you to explain a lot of variation around the standard predicted path. Amazingly successful theory. So we do have good theories of history for some kinds of things. Question is, can we have a theory of history that's like any of these that applies to human history? Is that plausible? Marx's attempt in historical materialism is really ambitious. It's an attempt to provide a theory of history not unlike the development of an organism from fertilized egg to mature adult to final destiny. It's a more ambitious theory than evolutionary biology. This is really important to kind of keep in mind, that the ambition of historical materialism is stronger than Darwin's theory, the evolution. And that's why it's actually incorrect, although sociologists do this all the time, to regard Marx as an evolutionary theory of history. It's not an evolutionary theory. If by the word evolution one means literally the analogy to the theory of biological evolution. The theory of biological evolution only explains how you got from some primordial origin to the present. It has nothing to say about ultimate destinies. theory of organismic development of the fertilized egg through embryo is a theory about ultimate destiny. It's about a theory of the entire trajectory, as is cosmology. You know, the theory of the universe is an attempt at a theory of the entire trajectory. Marx wanted a theory of the entire trajectory of human civilization. Well, that's an amazingly ambitious kind of theoretical project. Why bother? Why would you want it? You know, so that's great. It's an interesting intellectual exercise, fantastically ambitious. Do we need it? Do we need a theory like that? Would it be useful? Would it be relevant to the real deep project of a Marxist account, emancipatory social science, which is captured by the 11th thesis of Feuerbach? Philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point is to change it. Well, does having that interpretation of the world help us to change it? Well, I think if you could have a systematic, robust theory of history, it would help solve some crucial problems that a theory of social transformation faces. So, you know, if you could snap your fingers and have such a theory, if it is a possible theory, it would help solve some problems. The key problem, I think, is how do you make credible the possibility of a radical, emancipatory alternative to the world in which we live? So we live in a world where you've diagnosed the world as filled with oppressions, inequalities, domination, suffering. You want to transform that world into an emancipatory alternative. How do you add credibility? How do you convince people that another world is possible? So one classic answer to the idea that another world is possible is religion, divine revelation, you know, faith, epiphanies, divine revelation tells people, in some sense, that another world is possible. Religion can be thought of as specializing in the idea that the world that we see and experience isn't the only possible world, and the evidence for the alternative comes from some kind of non-empirical spiritual experience. But how do you do it in a secular context of reason and science, where you want to convince people by argument and data and evidence, not by, say, simply, I've been told by some higher power that this is true, believe me, which is essentially the way religion operates. It says, I have been told by, that's what prophets, a prophet says that. I have been told by a higher power this is true, believe me. A theory of history could provide a solution to that. And that's, I think, what Marx attempted in Historical Materialism. It's proposing a theory in which he tried to show that capitalism has an inherent tendency to destroy its own conditions of existence because of its internal dynamics, its own laws of motion. This would push capitalism along a trajectory that's knowable in advance. We know we are in the midst of this trajectory, and through this scientific understanding of its laws of motion, we understand where it's being pushed into the future. And the key conclusion of that theory is that capitalism is ultimately unsustainable. It destroys its own conditions of existence. So if this is solidly understood, if you've really demonstrated that capitalism does destroy its own conditions of existence, then it makes the task of convincing people that another world is possible a much simpler one, because it's inevitable that there will be another world. And then the question is, what kind of other world will it be? Will it be better or worse? If capitalism can destroy its own conditions of existence, well, the world might be worse afterwards rather than better. But at least you've established that the world as it is isn't the only possible world. There will be an alternative. And then you can say, well, it's up to us collectively through our struggles whether the world that replaces it is a better or worse one. And that's captured by the quip that the alternatives to capitalism are socialism or barbarism. That's a way of saying that the alternative may not be better. The barbarism part could be even worse. But it's up to us collectively to do it. Historical materialism, I think, is Marx's attempt at developing that kind of a theory. It's really the guts of it, the heart of it, is a theory of the destiny of capitalism. That's its point, is to establish firm theoretical foundations in which we can know something important about the destiny of capitalism. If you want to capture this point in a simple expression, which I've italicized here, I think that historical materialism is, above all, a theory of the history of the future. That's its point, is to have a history of the future, not a history of the past up to the present. The reason for developing the theory as a grand historical theory that really is from the past to the present and into the future is to anchor and give more credibility to the theory of the future. You have a better claim to saying, yes, we've understood the destiny of capitalism, if you also, with the same theory, can explain how we got here. Right, so it's, and I'll describe that contrast in a moment. But I would really want to emphasize that the key point of the theory of history would be intact, even if the theory of how we got here was incorrect, so long as the theory of the dynamics that propel us towards a particular future could be retained. It's just that that latter part, the theory of the destiny of capitalism, gets more theoretical strength from being embedded in a broader theory of overall history. Well, that's the kind of setup of this problem. This leads to a contrast between what can be called, and this is Roman numeral 2, a contrast between what could be called the general theory of history in historical materialism and the specific or special theory of capitalist history. Now, this is sort of an analogy to the theory of relativity. There's the general theory of relativity, and then there's the special theory of relativity, you know, in Einstein's formulation. Marx, I think, has a general theory of history that encompasses all of human history, the trajectory from the distant past through the present into the future. And then he has the specific theory of capitalist history, which is a theory about the development of capitalism once you get capitalism, through the present with its contradictions and towards some destination. Ultimately, I think the latter, the specific history of capitalist development, is the guts. That's the point. That's the heart of the theory. And the broader historical materialism was meant to add additional force to the special theory. But you can reject the general theory and not the special theory. They're not logically, it's not logically entailed. That is, you can reject the grand theory of overall human history as being unsatisfactory and perhaps impossible. So you could say it's not just that this version isn't satisfactory, that perhaps no version would be, and still retain the theory of capitalist history. But you may reject both. I mean, this isn't by way of affirming the latter. It's just that it doesn't really depend on it. But if both were true, the general theory adds additional weight to the special theory. It would be as if in biology, for example, you had a convincing theory of the evolution of mammals, but not of the overall evolution of species, so that you couldn't explain anything about how you get from single-celled animals to mammals. But once you get mammals, you can explain their speciation process, so you get the wide variety of critters that we have that are mammals. Well, that would be a pretty weird theory. I mean, it's kind of hard to even imagine how you could have a theory that would only apply to one kind of species. And that's why, indeed, our theory of the evolution of mammals gets way more convincing by virtue of the fact that it also explains fishes and insects and trees and dinosaurs, that, you know, things that don't even exist anymore. That's what makes the theory of the mammals so compelling, is because you know it's not just a specific theory of the specific kind of species. Well, but still, in principle, there could be very different theories at work for different kinds of of animals. Well, that's the kind of issue between the general theory and the special theory. What precisely, now I'll use, just to show our collective sophistication, I'll use the Latin term, explanandum. Explanandum just means object of explanation. So it's, you know, it's convenient to have. So just so you get the lingo here, explanans with an S, explanans is the thing which does the explaining, and the explanandum, and the plural is explananda, are the things which you are explaining. So that's roughly equivalent to dependent variables and independent variables in sociology speak. But what is the explanandum of the general theory in Marx? From here on, I'm going to be following G.A. Cohen's reconstruction of historical materialism. I think he's got it right. You know, there's lots of debates over this stuff, and lots of people disagree with aspects of Cohen's argument. I'm not a Marxologist. You know, I haven't delved into the original texts to be able to say, yes, this is completely faithful to Marx, what Marx the person wrote in the middle of the 19th century. But I do think it is the most coherent and systematic attempt at saying, okay, if this body of heterogeneous ideas that Marx wrote around a theory of history is to be a coherent theory, this is what the theory must be like. This is what would render it a coherent theory, and then we can ask the question, is it true? Is it or satisfactory or adequate, depending upon which evaluative criterion you want to use. I'm going to follow Cohen's account of this. So what Cohen says is, the explanandum of a theory of history, it's the overall trajectory of human history, and it can be divided into three broad stages that have actually occurred in history, and a fourth stage that is predicted by the theory. So the stages that are that have already happened are, first, pre-class society, communal societies with no class divisions. Ancient societies prior to what we call civilization. These are societies that Marx called primitive communism. The key thing about primitive communism is that these were societies without classes, communally organized in one way or another. That's the first form of society. The second form are pre-capitalist class societies. Now, this is a very heterogeneous assemblage of types. There are many different forms of pre-capitalist class societies. They all, however, are characterized by one critical characteristic, that is that exploitation is enforced by the direct coercion of labor. It's coercive extraction of surplus through direct coercion. They all have that in common. This includes slavery. It includes feudalism. It includes what is called by Marx, but in a, I think with a very unhelpful label, the Asiatic mode of production. It's a very un-Marxist term. You know, it's an example of how Marx, however brilliant, was not always concerned with conceptual precision in the way he would elaborate ideas. No mode of production should be named by a place. You know, it's a completely atheoretical idea, the Asiatic mode of production. It's sometimes been called the tributary mode of production, which captures its mechanisms better. The tributary mode of production has centralized state apparatuses with coercive capacity to extract surplus through some mechanism of taxation or tribute demands, but in which the surplus is itself produced in more communal forms, typically. Sometimes tributary mode of productions get combined with feudal mechanisms of extraction, so you have tributary and feudal combined. Sometimes it's tributary and communal combined. I think tributary is a better term than Asiatic. You know. And certainly, the expression Asiatic mode of production, which Marx used, he didn't write much about this, it was just invoked in a few places, is not a properly Marxian term. That is, from the point of view of the theoretical logic of the system of ideas, you would not call American capitalism the North American mode of production. You know, it just wouldn't make sense as a way of developing a typology of modes of production. So Cohen says you have pre-class societies, eventually you get capitalism, and between them you have a wide variety of different types of coercive class forms of production, class relations, in which the key idea is that in all of these, exploitation, that is the extraction of surplus from the people who produce it, occurs through direct application of force. That's the most clear in slavery. You know, obviously, that's the most directly and immediately and pervasively coercive form of labor of surplus extraction. It's true in feudalism, which organizes coercion differently than does slavery. And it's true in the tributary form of production, which organizes the direct coercive extraction differently again. What Cohen then says is that set of different heterogeneous forms of economy, of economic structure, they all are subsumed under the same stage within a theory of history. They are all between pre-class society and capitalist society. And then there's one predicted future form of society, which is post-capitalist non-class society. Now I'm giving it that awkward expression rather than labeling it communism or socialism, to leave open the particular institutional form. And there's particular baggage that comes with the term socialism and communism, which is unnecessary for this point. So we've got four stages. And the claim is human history, from its ancient roots to its future destination, can be divided into four types of societies: pre-class, pre-capitalist class, capitalism, and post-capitalist non-class society. And this long trajectory contains two transitions which we can observe that have already happened, and one transition which we predict. So what needs to be explained in order for this to be a coherent account? You first of all have to be able to describe these stages as real descriptively adequate demarcations of human history. And then you have to explain the transitions between pre-class and pre-capitalist class society and between pre-capitalist society and capitalism. And the question is, can we have a single theory which explains all that? Is there some single theory? That is, by single theory I mean a theory that specifies mechanisms and processes, in which the same mechanisms and processes help us explain the emergence of class society out of pre-class society, and the same mechanisms explain the emergence of capitalism out of pre-capitalist societies. And by virtue of having explained those transitions, we predict it will also explain the future transition. Now again, note that that's what evolutionary biology, which can't predict the future, still has this structure. The explanation of the transition between a world of multicellular sea creatures to land animals is the same as the explanation of the emergence of mammals among land animals. It's the same theory, the same mechanisms. Natural selection on random variation through sexual reproduction. It's exactly the same mechanisms apply to each transition. So we have these great eras, you know, the Jurassic and the Shmurassic and whatever, you know, the Cretaceous and, you know, a few of the names. and each of them that were in the past no longer exist. The creatures are gone. And the same theory explains all the transitions. Amazing. Well, what we've got here are three historic forms of society with two transitions. Can we develop a singular theory that explains all of that? And if so, it's a candidate theory for explaining the destiny. So you can see why this is really cool. You know, it's really, really interesting to imagine that you could pull this off. Here is the core intuition. So let me give you, in a sense, it's a pre-theoretical intuition, because there's not yet any specification of mechanisms. So the core theoretical intuition, pre-theoretical intuition, I think has two components. One is, if we look back over the grand sweep of human history, is there anything about this grand sweep that seems to have any directionality to it? Is there anything about what's happened since Neolithic times up to the present, which looks at least roughly in a coarse-grained way, like it moves in one direction, not just randomly, not just one damn thing after another, but it seems to have some kind of directionality? Well, Marx and the Marxian intuition is, yes, there is something about this grand sweep that does seem to have at least a rough first approximation directionality. And that is the development of our capacity to transform nature. And if you look more deeply at that, you can say really, really what seems to have directionality is our knowledge about how to transform nature. It's really knowledge. So the development of the forces of production, that classic expression, it just seems pretty clear that, you know, hand stone tools are different from bronze tools, are different from, you know, settled agriculture, are different from industrial production, are different from computers and electronic and all the things going on now, and that there's a sense in which this has directionality to it. The latter stages depended upon the former. They built upon them. They transformed the earlier forces of production into more advanced, the expression more advanced. Again, this is pre-theoretical. It seems to have some really strong intuitive idea that our current forces of production are more productive than previous ones. So there was a time in which it took 98% of the population to produce the necessary food for 100%. Now it takes 2% of the population to produce enough food for 100%. There's something really different about those two worlds, and it's captured by the notion of higher productivity, but even more deeply by the idea of knowledge. So the first intuition is there's something directional and cumulative about our knowledge about how to survive in the natural world. It doesn't mean that there's never reversals, you can, but reversals have to have the character of losing knowledge. Jerry Cohen has a really nice little metaphor for this. Imagine, he says contemporary Britain, he was a professor at Oxford. Imagine that all of the knowledge of industrial society and science and technology went back to the Neolithic era, but all the machinery, all the physical infrastructure of the modern world was present. What would happen? And now let's imagine a different situation. All the machines suddenly disappear, but all the knowledge is intact. What would happen? Well, if all the machinery, all the modern technology, all the infrastructure simply vanished, but all the knowledge remained, there'd be massive suffering, huge dislocations, but you'd expect within a few generations things would have moved back to at least many of the elements of the prior situation. It would not take another 40,000 years to get back to where the actual higher productivity. If all the knowledge disappeared and you still had all the machines and robots and computers and people had Neolithic understandings of how the world worked, it would all deteriorate and disappear and people would be back to Neolithic times. That's his evidence, I think, correct. It's a very nice thought experiment as to why when we say the forces of production develop, what we really mean is that the knowledge that's embodied in those forces of production develops. And it has directionality, and it's cumulative. It builds on it. So that's one intuition. But there is this long sweeping development of the force of production. And the second intuition is that if you had 1,000 planets, so we're going back to A Wonderful Life, if you had 1,000 planets, all of which had they were ecologically identical to the Earth on which we live, and you had hominids who became Homo sapiens about 100,000 years ago. So you have modern human biological capacities with big brains and complex cognitive capacities, and they live on the savannas of Africa, or wherever, you know, whatever the current understanding of where Homo sapiens originated. And you have the same planet, and but you have 1,000 of them. In all of them, the forces of production would have developed. All of them, everyone, 100%. Not 3 of them out of 1,000. The pace at which they develop would be different. No reason to believe that there aren't accidents that affect the pace. But in all of them, the forces of production would develop. And eventually, with enough time, all of them would become capitalist. And they would have started as non-capitalist, and they would end up in capitalist. And between the non-capitalist and the capitalist, there would have been coercive forms of class relations. In all of them. That's the intuition. And that intuition then says, okay, what must the theory, what kind of a theory would help us understand that, given that intuition? Now, the intuitions could be wrong. It could be the case that it's not going to be in 1,000 cases. It may be only in a few cases that you get capitalism, and some of the other ones you'll forever and forever end up with just hunters and gatherers. Hunter and gathering societies might continue forever. No reason for the force of production to develop. Or some of them might develop communal settled agriculture, be happy as clams doing that, and never develop into complex divisions of labor. Maybe so. No. The argument is that's wrong. They would all develop in this way. The trajectory is knowable. And I'll leave you with that thought for our break. And you can see why this is really, it's exciting stuff to really think about. Even if in the end it's flawed. It's okay, let's take 20 after, let's reconvene.